Yeah, she did say that she was going to be on tonight. She sent me an email, so.
Okay.
If you want to wait or not, it's up to you. I am recording, so.
Well, we still have another minute. So, Susan, is this everything you thought it would be?
Oh, yes. Actually, I'm very excited about the what I think is the slide deck that was a part of the materials for tonight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We don't disappoint.
Yeah, it looked pretty interesting. Mark and Bernie, I made you co-hosts, so when you guys come up on the agenda, you can put your PowerPoint up on the screen.
We may be joined by an intern with Wharton Pace. Her name is Humna Sharif. I don't know if she'll join. She's a Yale master's candidate in school environment.
I'm going to let Dave Madigan in, okay?
Yeah, I just clicked on him.
Great.
What's her name, Mark?
Humna.
My son is in the same program.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Boy, we've got two interns that are just in and out of the park.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, they're really great.
They're really something. Funny, we may never meet her in person, but we only see her on Zoom.
Can you guys hear me? Am I?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, we got you, Mark.
Okay.
All right, Glenn, we're going to start.
Okay, I am recording, so go ahead.
All right, so it's 7:01, and I will call the meeting to order. And we have Candace, Nancy, Dave, Mark, and Susan in attendance. So we have a quorum, so we'll go to the public forum. Anybody in the public here for a reason? Then we'll move to the special guest. Do you want to be called Bernie or Bernard?
Bernie is great.
And Bernie Pelletier and Mark Scully are guests tonight from PACE. They provide us with a pretty interesting PowerPoint presentation. And so I will turn it over to you two.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting us. I actually had I attended a meeting of this group a couple of years ago. I don't know if I think Mark was on then, and maybe others. But but it's great to be back. I think our work and the model that we run for towns has changed quite a bit. So we're really excited to be back. So let me share my screen. We'll jump right into the presentation. So Bernie and I are president and vice president of People's Action for Clean Energy, and PACE actually as you may know has a strong attachment to Canton. PACE was run for over 40 years by a woman named Judy Friedman, who lived in Canton. And the work of PACE over the last few years is really focused solely on working with people like you, working with towns. We have this fundamental, it's not even a belief, it's evidence that so much happens at the town level that can only happen at the town level. And of course, we need federal policies, which have been lacking. We need individual actions, and we need state actions, but there's so much that we've seen happen at the town level. So we're really all about working with towns and helping provide resources, provide tools. So it looks like somebody else is trying to come in. So the project that we're talking about tonight is called, it's a PACE 100% CT project. Shall we let 1-860-693 back in or in?
I did. Yeah.
For that.
I so can't see the screen who it is. Is there just a phone number there?
693-4768.
No, it's Canton number.
Yeah.
Are you asking to identify the themselves, maybe?
You have to let them in first, I think.
Well, townspeople are allowed to listen.
I let the person in and I asked them to unmute, but they're not unmuting, so they're probably just listening in.
Okay.
So this project is it was born somewhat out of a curiosity of what would it look like if a town tried to commit to an entirely renewable economy. I think it was based a little bit out of frustration that when we look at the pace of changes around us and we look at what's happening to our climate, that things aren't happening fast enough. So we kind of fast forwarded and said, well, let's look at what this 100% renewable economy would look like. And so we set about really trying to model that for individual towns. So there's five steps here shown here. The first is what we're really doing tonight, which is benchmarking your current energy usage, looking at how much energy you're currently using. And this is everybody. This is not just the municipality, it's the residents and the businesses. And then look at how could we reduce that? And it's really two pieces to that. One is efficiency and conservation, and the other is simply electrifying everything. When you look at the experts, they say, ultimately, this needs to be an electric economy. We're using electric transportation, we're heating and cooling, using electric heat pumps. So we're not burning stuff anymore. And then the siting survey was this sense of curiosity. How much renewable could we actually site in town? The idea is not that we're going to produce 100% in town, but let's look at what we can responsibly do. Another step is the grid itself. The grid was built in a different time. I think, as Bernie says, Westinghouse would Edison would recognize this grid today. It was built for large central power plants, sending power out in one direction. Now, with many businesses and residents both consuming and producing energy and multi-directional flows and storage and combined heat and power, it's a much more complex grid that we're going to need to get to this future. And then the last step is really what we'll talk a little bit about is how do we get there? What are some of the concrete steps? So this is a graph that kind of shows the overall process. And the blue bars on the left are our estimate of how much energy you're currently using. So we can get the amount of electricity that you consume from the electric utility, and that's 59 gigawatt hours a year. Natural gas, we can get that figure also from the gas utility, and those are publicly available. We convert everything here to one unit. In this case, it's gigawatt hours. We actually have Glenn provided us with grantless information on buildings and vehicles in town. So we look at the buildings, we look at the square footage, we make a lot of assumptions about heating oil is used, how much electricity is used for heating. We can add those up. And we've got other heat. Transportation, we look at vehicles, different types of vehicles, make assumptions about miles per gallon, miles driven per year. We simply add it all up. So for Canton in 1 year, our estimate is you use 349 gigawatt hours of energy in a year. Now that number in itself may not mean that much. Well, often what's interesting is kind of the split. You can see in this case, almost half, maybe a little less, 45% or so, is transportation. That's a big piece. From town to town, the share of gas is going to vary. Some towns have lots of natural gas, some have none. But you can see that's sort of the composition of where you're in the energy that the town is currently using. So from that total of 349, now we work our way down using conservation, efficiency, and electrification. We'll come back to these numbers, but while these numbers look extremely aggressive, we do believe that they're reasonable, that given these steps that we're talking about, your new energy load would actually be only 139, so a significant reduction. And then the question is, how much could we site locally? And we have a number there. I don't want to say this is based on a lot of detailed analysis, but we have a number, 30 gigawatt hours. So the rest, 109, we're going to need from the regional grid. I don't want to say this is the right answer. I think it's a good faith estimate at these numbers. We'd love it if you all took this and said, you know, you're crazy here. This is not right. You don't know us. And actually, you know, work on it and sort of own it. But we'd love to walk you through the process on how we did these estimates. The other way of looking at it is over time, that where we are today, again, that 349 is how much we're using right now. If we did nothing, then chances are by better technology and more efficiency, there'd be a slight decline in our energy usage over time. So that's that business as usual blue line. But if we take these measures seriously that we talked about, if we're all driving electric vehicles and we're doing electric transportation through buses, and we're taking advantage of home energy retrofits and just reducing the amount of energy that we're using, we can reduce energy by that gray slice. So the total energy that we're using is really this red bar, and it really, as we said, it's dropping significantly. A very aggressive assumptions there. And then on the bottom, we're starting at a pretty low level of current renewable energy, right? We actually have some numbers for how much you have in Canton right now. But as we deploy more and more renewables, ultimately we end up with a much lower energy load, and it's all renewable, so that this non-renewable red section is getting essentially squeezed out by efficiency and electrification on the top and renewables on the bottom. So that's a sort of a way of seeing this this process. So I'm going to hand over to Bernie now.
Great. Thank you, Mark. We are excited to be here. This is really great. I think this might be the 22nd or 23rd town that we've done this analysis on, and we learn a little bit every time we do a town. So some of this is sort of retracing what Mark said. I would venture to say that we have not gone into a single town that knew what their total energy use was. Lots of municipalities know what their schools and towns use, town buildings use, but no one knows what their residences and business and municipalities use. So we include the whole town, residents, commercial, and municipal. Electricity and natural gas, just like Mark said, since 2012, it's been a Connecticut statute that the utilities have to give us the aggregate consumption. So those are actual numbers. We have a 4-year track record of those numbers, so you can track your progress over time. We estimate heating oil use. So in your mind, you might say, okay, these guys are making up numbers, but yeah, we are, but with a lot of data, a lot of Canton-specific data. So we use your grand list. We know the fuel type of every residence, every business, every condo in Canton, and we know their square feet, and we can use pretty well-established energy use per square foot numbers to get us that consumption for oil and propane. Likewise for transportation, I think you might have something like 10,000 vehicles in Canton. We know what they are, we know how old they are, we know how many are EVs and how many are plug-in EVs, and there's a Connecticut use code associated with those that enables us to take government statistics, vehicle miles traveled, miles per gallon, which gives us gallons of transportation fuel. Like Mark said, a lot of people don't relate to gigawatt hours. That's billion watt hours. But it's sort of like a million kilowatts. And the reason we convert to that is it's on one footing. We call it the euro of energy. You can take francs and marks and lira and convert them all to euros, if you will. And likewise, we can do that with gigawatt hours. And if you're interested and you have the stamina, there are calculations in the appendix. So we won't go through all of these numbers, but it is kind of interesting to take that gigawatt number, which nobody can relate to, and go ahead and try to relate it. So if you have almost 11,000 people in Canton, you've got 434 businesses, you have employment for about 3,500 people. You can see in that second block of numbers, there's the 349 total number again. And what we do here, just to give you a couple averages, average energy values, residential kilowatt hours per person is 23,327. In the group of people that are on this call tonight, you might be some of the few people who actually have any idea how much electricity they use every month and every year. If you do, you're probably surprised how high that's 23,000. You say, I don't use 23,000 a year. But that 23,000 represents your electricity use, so your Eversource bill, your gasoline or diesel, whichever you use, and your heating fuel, all turned into kilowatt hours. So that's why it's as high as it is. And the same deal, we can take the commercial number and divide it by either employees or businesses. And as you know, as you would expect, when you look at per business, it's 217,000 per year per business. So you have a couple big employers out there that use a lot of power, whether it be electricity or gas or a transportation fleet. What kind of perks people up? And this is another number that people never see, including individuals on this call, I'm going to guess. Speaking for myself and maybe for you, how much money do I spend on energy in a year? Well, I think of my Eversource bill, and I think of my CNG bill, and I think of my gasoline bill, but I don't ever put it all together. Well, because we have these numbers, we can put it all together. It's $31 million is basically flowing out of your pockets in Canton and into the energy folks. Some of those businesses are in Canton, but lots of those businesses are not in Canton. So you can think of it as a net drain out of Canton of something like $31 million a year. And per person, per resident, they spend about $1,000 a year. So that's every man, woman, and baby, $2,000 a year. And for every business, something like $20,000 a year. So that's a lot of money. And we can also, since we have these aggregate statistics, really easily turn them into greenhouse gas numbers. Some people are surprised by this. Per person, just what doing what we all do, driving, heating, using our cell phones, etc., we each generate about 9 tons per year per person of carbon dioxide. So, and that we can actually pull that there. And now we're not going to go through all of these numbers, but this is the table that comes out of the analysis. And maybe if, just to give you another flavor, and I see Candace has raised her hand.
I was just checking to make sure you were paying attention. No, I'm just kidding. So I was just curious on the previous slide where you had, I think you said 8.8 tons.
Yep.
Okay. Where does it take into effect farms and farm animals and all that too?
No. Actually, that's a really good point. It takes into account all the energy we use as gas, oil, propane, heating fuel, natural gas, electricity, but does not include methane, does not include any garbage dumps or anything or any of that.
Oh, yeah, the dump, yeah.
So it's really good clarification. Really, the greenhouse gas per person per year from energy consumption.
Okay, thank you.
Those other numbers are significant. The agriculture numbers are significant, but they aren't as big. They typically, I'm making this up, but they might be a tenth of the energy numbers. So they're nothing to sneeze at, but the big dog in terms of greenhouse gas production is energy, at least in Connecticut. I don't know when you get to big hog farms in North Carolina, it's probably different. So across the top, you can see that we have this broken down commercial and residential, which you can total up. Your municipal operations, your Canton schools, your office buildings, et cetera, live within the commercial block there. If you have separate numbers, we can spike them out of the commercial numbers. And the rest is just basically transforming it into gigawatt hours and greenhouse gas, which I won't spend any more time, I think, on that. Again, to just go one scooch deeper than Mark did, we really have that radical reduction in energy from two things. One would be efficiency. So to the extent that you have a lot of older residences in Canton, just like we do in West Hartford and Finsbury, many of them, surprisingly, even now, are poorly or not insulated. And it's easy to see as the winter weather approaches and we get that first little snowfall. Just go look at somebody's roof and you can tell whether they're insulated or not. So that'd be an example of efficiency. Let's insulate those. I think it's the National Renewable Energy Lab says that we can probably button up Connecticut's housing stock by about 26%, just air sealing and insulating. The other piece of it that Mark talked about is electrifications. And you can call it beneficial electrification, strategic electrification, but adoption of renewable thermal technology, which is, in our use, mostly heat pumps. Why they're our go-to source is because when you burn something, the most you can get out of it is 100%. But a heat pump is not burning something, it is moving something. It's moving heat from here to there, it's moving cool from here to there. And so you can actually put in one unit of heat, one unit of energy, I should say, and move 4 units of heat, 3 to 4 units of heat. So you actually can have efficiencies, and I know this sounds like witchcraft of a sort, of 300 or 400%. And that's the driver to getting these efficiencies on the heating side. Likewise, electric vehicles are much more efficient. So looking at this, looking at the two bars on the right, you can see transportation, the amount of energy that all of us who have ICE, internal combustion cars, use versus if we went to a battery electric vehicle. You don't have to believe me or Mark when we show you these numbers. If you pull up the EPA mileage sticker for a Chevy Volt, which operates both in electric mode and gas mode, or a Prius Prime, which is again operates in gas or electric mode, just look at the electric mode versus the gas mode, and you'll see that difference play out right there. Just as Mark said. So if you look at the Chevy Volt, you can see it's 106 miles electric, miles per gallon electric, and it's 42 miles per gallon when it's operating in gas. It's a perfect experiment. Same driver, same car, same route, two different miles per gallon, with quotes around miles per gallon. So that's, in a quick nutshell, that's the radical reduction. Do common sense air sealing insulation, electrify your heating, which you can do once you've insulated properly, and electrify your transport. So where do we get this energy? I'm going to guess that you are like many environmentally conscious people. You love nature, you love farmland, you love forests, you love greenery, and you like renewable power. And there is a sweet spot, and this is the sweet spot that we're searching for, and it's out there. We want to responsibly site that solar. So that field on the upper left, which these are just stock, well, that one's a stock photo. The only way we would site a solar field in a nice farm area like that is if we had more farmland and we knew what to do with. But it's a beautiful place to site it if that's the case. By contrast, the other two examples on Mark is, what is that one? Is that Simsbury High or is that
the upper right is the Stop and Shop. It's Simsbury Commons. So it's the cinema and the Stop and Shop and the strip mall.
So it's already got something on it. If you have things growing in your parking lot, you have other problems. So we put solar on that. We can model that. And one of our favorite things, especially now, is solar carports. You've got something, there are just a bunch of cars on it. Let's put some solar on it. There's a whole bunch of, for another topic, another night, we can talk about the beauty of that. And what we love to do with this project is to come in and just show you some of your own local areas. So you can take the Canton High School. starting in the upper left. And our estimate there, if you look at the parking lot, you can get 891 megawatt hours a year, almost a gigawatt off of that. If you look at the Canton shops and look at that beautiful parking lot, you can get almost 2 gigawatt hours.
And that's the back of Canton shops by Dick's and Barnes & Noble.
And likewise, Mill Pond Park, you can get a good chunk out of there as well. These are obviously hypothetical. If you want to see it in actuality, you can go out to West Farms Mall in Farmington, or you can go out to Manchester and look at Buckland Hills. They're starting to put them up out there as well. So, like Mark said, if Tesla and Westinghouse and Edison came back, they'd recognize the grid on the top, which is you got a big power plant pumping power out to us consumers. The world that we have our toe in, but the world we have to dive into is the world on the bottom, which is that it's a distributed generation world. There's multi-directional flows. There'll be times when there's more power flowing off of your roof and going back than there is, you know, coming to you. Right now, that plays havoc. They know how to do it. They being Eversource and Niner Illuminating. They just have to do it. They also, another big problem, as our president likes to remind us, is the wind doesn't always blow. So these renewables are intermittent, and there are just a lot of ways around that. And we're not going to go into this. This was a wonderful discussion that would take a long time to have, but this is an actual sort of high-level block diagram of the east end of Long Island. It was done by a group called Clean Coalition. We call them out because they, right now, if you think about microgrids, it's typically a campus. It might be a school, university, it might be a factory. They really promote this idea of community microgrids, which is to say, you've got people all over, you've got businesses, municipal, residential, and they're all on this grid together. And so it's segmented. If you, without going into it, those little pink boxes represent a segmentation of the grid. So if a tree falls on Susan's part of the grid, the other parts of the grid don't go down. So that's sort of one thing. Break up the grid into standalone pieces. In every piece of that grid, put two things. Put some local solar or wind, or in your case out in Canton, some local hydro. So you've got a sort of a consistent energy source, and put some storage. And then you don't, the lights, you might have to turn off a few lights, but you don't ever really have to go all the way dark. You certainly don't have to go all the way dark for 10 or 13 days like has happened to us in a couple winters. So that was a warp speed tour of that. Some takeaways, next steps, just to repeat. As Mark showed with his very colorful Christmas diagram there, clean renewable power over time will replace non-renewable power. The sooner, the better. In the end, all energy is going to be electric. Some of it sourced locally, and some of it from the grid. Even when we say it's from the grid, the grid is going to be a lot more local, in our view. It'll be offshore wind. It might be some solar fields in other parts of Connecticut or New York. So transportation and heating will transition to electric. Microgrids are going to be the building block, we believe, of resiliency, which I think is of interest to every municipal management in Connecticut and elsewhere. And it also enables the distribution of energy resources. And towns are the building block. So much happens here. You need the federal, like Mark said, you need the state, but we have to work towards the goals that have been laid out. I think Mark and I are both strongly of the mind that the role of municipalities has largely been underplayed. So we're the ones that can do energy efficiency. We're the ones that can persuade people and help shape where things are sited. We're the ones that can model transitions of electric to electric transportation and heat, and we're the ones that are going to have to set up the microgrids. So it's us. No pressure, you guys.
So now we look at, so we've kind of modeled high level how much energy the town is currently using, how much it would use in this new scenario, and we've said that there's a role for the town. Let's dig down a little bit into what we as members of a town, of a clean energy task force, as municipal representatives can actually achieve. And one big question is, the focus here is solar. You're actually one of the few towns that has something else. You, as Bernie said, you have hydro. And some towns might have some wind, but in Connecticut, for most towns, it's really a question of solar. So our focus is, how much solar can we responsibly site in town? And the goal is not every town produces 100% of its energy locally. Not by any means. But what we tried to do is put together an estimate of how much we could fit in town. And so we've got some really high-level calculations. We're not going to go into them in detail, but we look at the number of homes and condos. We say
20. Excuse me, Mark.
Yeah.
Mark, before we go on a little bit further, I have a question sent to me to the previous screens. And maybe Bernie is the one. Do you want to take questions as we go through the slides?
Sure, or, sure.
Okay. So in the previous slides, talking about microgrids, the question that was sent to me was, well, I got to find it again. Why are the utilities dragging their feet and moving to the microgrid direction?
That's a really interesting question. Mark actually tried to get a microgrid going in, a community microgrid going in Simsbury. They had to essentially use the solar on Simsbury High's roof and parking lot, brought in a grocery store, a gas station, I think a storage facility. And it wasn't necessarily that the utilities were fighting it. It was that the two things, the economics, they wanted us to bury the lines. And I think, Mark, was it $1 million a mile to bury the lines?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
So I would have argued that I would rather have not have buried the lines, not have spent $1 million, but have had the microgrid. But that was, I don't even know whether to blame that on the utility. And the other thing that I think ultimately defeated us was that natural gas is cheap, and they decided, I think, to go with natural gas generator, I think.
A fuel cell,
A fuel cell, I guess. Which I don't think they ever built, did they, Mark?
They did, I think, as far as I know, yeah.
Okay.
It does add complexity to the grid, so I think, you know, the utilities would naturally prefer to live in a simpler system, but you know, as Bernie said, we actually got a lot of support from Eversource in trying to make this happen in Simsbury, so it's in their interest, and I think we've seen utilities in other places in the country support these because it can play a significant role in stabilizing the grid. But I think, as Bernie said, the economics are still very challenging.
But who demanded the underground lines be laid?
That was a requirement specific to the deep microgrid grant program, that the focus was resiliency. So if they spent all this money and they gave us a grant to support building a grid, and then we have a windstorm or we have a hurricane and the thing is still out, then they didn't achieve their goal of resiliency. So but I think, as Bernie said, and in other places in the country, that's not a requirement. It's a nice to have, but it's going to kill a lot of microgrid projects if you insist on that.
Right, but The point of that program was resiliency, and the state was given a lot of money. That program came out of the big storms we had like 10 years ago.
Yep.
So that was the point. It was, the point is to be resilient. So we have most of the outages in Connecticut are from downed trees and in branches. And if we just have microgrids that are supposed to be, you know, back up to the system, and we have overhead lines, it doesn't really do anything. So that's why that was was the case.
Yep.
Yeah, it does, Mark, I think it does make sense. I don't think we're arguing against the point. It's just that in order to do this project, we had to do this other project, both of which were good projects, but by the time you got the economics, it was wrong.
Right.
And the basic question, I think the answer is there's not a lot of motivation on the part of the utilities to promote microgrids because they give up revenue typically when that happens. So they might be begrudging participants, but they're not the ones pushing microgrids. It needs to come from the towns and it needs to come from the individuals in town to see the benefits of a microgrid.
Yep. And unfortunately, if your only goal is resiliency, then typically diesel generators are going to be a cheaper option right now, unfortunately.
Well, that was not the only goal. Like, the goal was to keep it renewable, so diesels weren't given, none of them were done by diesel, so.
Right, yeah.
Most of them were fuel cells and with some solar.
A couple of things are changing, though, and not to go on this topic too much, but first of all, I'll say even 5 years ago, the design of every microgrid was completely unique. I think an engineering company up in Massachusetts actually donated the single line drawing for the one in Simsbury. There you see, I think, is it Schneider Electric or I forget, it's somebody like that that's coming out with almost like microgrids in a box. So these things are not the esoteric creatures that they once were. So some of the costs are coming down. Some of the battery storage costs are coming down. And I think people are starting to catch on to the value. And like Mark was saying, I think people are wary now of diesel for a bunch of reasons. And so if you're a shoreline community, if you're Brantford or Milford, I think these things are starting to look more and more attractive with each passing year.
So I have a question. A couple slides back, you were talking about, you know, what we need to move towards, you know, the electric cars, the heat pumps, et cetera. So as you probably know, the state of Connecticut has some of the highest electrical rates in the country, right? So how are you moving the needle with people and incentivizing them, you know, to get them to change when their change obviously is going to cost them money because their electrical bill is going to go up, but maybe we don't have the benefit of all the rooftop solar or the renewables really in place yet?
That's a great question. What I would ask is, can we come back to it? We have a slide where we talk about the economics and mm-hmm. If we don't answer it there, let's please ask that again. So this question of how much solar we can site in town, it's not a matter of literally what's the maximum amount if we put it on every rooftop and put carports over every parking lot. It's really a matter of how much we want responsibly, right? As Bernie said, we want to preserve agricultural lands. We don't want to cut down forests. We don't want to destroy or tarnish aesthetically or historically significant properties. So these are discussions that I think we want to have proactively with town, you know, in the town. And what are some places where we think would be good opportunities for developing solar? What are some that we want to have off limits? This is one of the biggest examples. This is not the right answer here. This is more of a really high level estimate. So we've looked at how many residences we have, homes and condos. We said 20% might be suitable for a 7 kilowatt array. So that's 5.8 megawatts on rooftops. Commercial, we've got the square footage of your rooftop, or your commercial rooftops. We've made the similar assumptions, 20%. And an amount of installed capacity per square foot. So we come up with a total of 12.4. For most towns, we actually have, Google has done estimates. You might want to take a look at Google Project Sunroof, and it actually has an estimate. Canton is one of the few towns they haven't done. But so we're just having a really high level estimate, 12.4 megawatts of solar on rooftops in Canton. And we'd love to work with you if you want to try and actually do a more refined estimate there. From the Green Bank, we have an estimate that you have about 1 megawatt installed right now. And then this is nothing more than a placeholder, but PACE has actually started to do some interesting analysis of how much solar we could fit on carports in various towns. We haven't done an estimate for Canton yet, but I got a placeholder of 5 megawatts over. We're talking about the type of things that we looked at before at the high school, at the Canton shops and other places. Five megawatt is probably on the low side. And then this other is sort of other pieces of land. There may be some rights of way. There might be some land that is not primed for development. Simsbury had a somewhat controversial 26 megawatt solar farm that's now operational. So this estimate's probably low too, but again, I'm not holding these out as the right numbers. It's just a high level estimate. So add it up and it's 22 megawatts of capacity, which could generate roughly 30 gigawatt hours per year. And the exercise that we would encourage you to go through, in addition to really refining this estimate, is over on the right here. Let's start to think through how much of that could we actually have deployed by 2025. And I've thrown in some percentages here, right? They're nothing more than placeholders or guesses, right? How much could we deploy by 2030, 2040, 2050? And then by implication, here's the amount of energy we could produce. So then this graph shows that. So again, it's not like these are the right numbers, but here's something we want to start to think about in really tangible terms. How much can we do in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20?
So when you talk about this, is this property that we're going to use, we're going to develop solar for use by the town, or is that going to be made available for developers to sell the grid? How's that done?
This is everything. So it's the whole town, and it would be, the municipality itself and the schools might want to put solar on rooftops and on parking lots for the schools. The town might want to put some on their buildings and on parking lots. Maybe there's pieces of land at public works or other places. But it also includes what residents will put on their rooftops, what businesses will put on their rooftops, what developers will come in and say, "Hey, I'd like to buy this piece of land and put a 2 megawatt array up." So it's everything.
Okay.
So I have a question. You mentioned the Simsbury, the solar array. So how much of that energy is going back to Simsbury?
It's that one is connected directly to the transmission grid.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So it is, those electrons aren't going far. They're going to be used in the region, but technically they're not going to Simsbury, businesses,
right,
and residences.
Right. And is that...
hydro.
Exactly. I was just going to say the same as our hydro.
Right. Okay. But again, I'm not so, who owns the electrons as they flow is of less concern to me than producing them in a renewable kind of way. So the fact that we've made the hydro happen after 10 years of hard hard work and often frustration, whether we're actually purchasing those electrons or someone else does, I'm just happy to see them generated renewably. So
yeah. So again, this is really, really nothing more than a mental exercise of how much do we think we can site, where do we want to site it, where don't we want to site it, and at what pace is it realistic for us to do that? And so that's sort of, and again, we'd love to work with you. And we did these simple estimates of these three sites. We'd be happy to sort of work with you to do some more and refine that estimate. The next piece is this electrification, right? A big part, and this is we're in this section now of what can a town do, right? So the question here is, at what rate can we transition to electric transportation? And on the left, you see the residential vehicle mix, and right now, we actually have the numbers. Do we have it shown? You've got 0.3% of your residential vehicles are electric. We got your grand list. We decoded each VIN so we know whether it's an internal combustion electric, internal combustion engine, a battery electric, or a plug-in hybrid. So right now, you've got 0.3% of your residential vehicles are electric, 0% are commercial. At what rate and how are we going to get to transitioning to electric vehicles? There are ways that the town can become EV ready, right? There's ways of planning your charging infrastructure. There's ways of perhaps even building codes that require electric, that buildings and residences to be electric vehicle ready. There's even talk of policies now about cash for clunkers buying old internal combustion. So all kinds of policies we can talk about, but what's within the town's realm of possibility to transition to electric vehicles? And so again, we've just shown some assumptions here, and then you can see over time then, based on those assumptions, we're transitioning from electric, from internal combustion engine to electric vehicles. And we've shown that for residential and commercial. Similarly, we want to work to transition from the various heating and cooling fuels that we have now to an electric. So you can see on the left here, we've got residential heating and cooling, and you've got a mix here of gas, the natural gas, oil, quite a bit of oil in Canton, electric, some electric resistance, and then other. And over time, again, based on some assumptions that we can make, we want to transition to phasing out the fossil fuel sources of heating and cooling to end up with really an all-electric. So we've got assumptions here for both residential and commercial. Again, it's really nothing more than an exercise of what policies, what incentives are we going to need. You can see the numbers here right now. I think you were one of the few towns that actually codes whether a building is heated with a heat pump. So you've got, if the numbers are correct, your grand list says you've got 7 residents with heat pumps right now. If we're going to get to 5% in 2025, that's 206 we're going to need in 5 years. How are we going to achieve that? Pace is working on a pilot campaign with 2 towns right now in Connecticut to promote heat pumps, similar to the Solarize campaign that I know Canton did a while back. So there's different ways of incentivizing. So again, this is just to kind of, I think what we're trying to do with these slides is make this transition real, help us to actually see it. It's not just a matter of declaring we're going to get to 100%, we're going to pass a resolution, but what steps does it actually take?
This question,
please.
About heat pumps, I lived in Alabama for a couple of years and had a heat pump and actually considered putting one in when I moved back here. And the research that I did suggested that given our climate and the average winter temperatures, that might not be the right way to go. So is there a new technology with heat pumps right now that makes them more applicable to our climate?
Yeah, I don't want to oversimplify this discussion. Heat pumps are the cold climate heat pumps that have been developed really probably in the last 5 to 10 years. They are much more efficient. They do go down to colder temperatures. The efficiency declines when you get down, but they do go down to minus 13 or so. And it's not a slam dunk that a heat pump is the most efficient or the most cost economic. If you've got electric resistance heating now, it absolutely is going to be more efficient and more economical. Typically, oil and propane, it's also a good decision, but it's also, there are ways of transitioning to heat pumps that you keep your current heating system, but you supplement it with heat pumps. And that first heat pump typically can significantly reduce your energy bill. You might keep the old system, but at the same time also do some weatherization. So it's not a simple discussion, right? But and we probably are going to need some better incentives to make this happen, right?
Thanks.
So this this chart is intends to show kind of like an earlier chart, but this is actually a much more detailed projection that we've done for Connecticut and then for individual towns. So if we start on the left here, the 2020, again, that number 349 is what you're currently using in energy. And you can see how it breaks down. You've got up at the very top, we're burning oil locally, we're burning gas locally, we're burning gasoline for our cars, right? That includes diesel. So scale, you can see those are really significant in their scale. The brown, now we're down to what it comes from the grid. So the brown is the non-renewable portion of the electric grid. Orange is nuclear. And then we've got some renewables on the bottom. Fairly small amounts. We've got both regional renewables. We've got grid wind. We've got grid solar. And then in the very bottom, we've got local solar. Over time, by transitioning to electric transportation, to electric heating and cooling, we're going to stop burning oil. We're going to stop burning gas. We're going to stop burning gasoline. Over time, the grid will get rid of all of the coal and the natural gas power stations. We'll get rid of nuclear. So that in the end, what we'll have is, if we jump over to 2050, we've got local, we've got rooftop solar is the dark green. We've got some carports, we've got other local, and then, as I said before, those are probably understated. But just to point out, that's only a fraction of what we're going to be using, right? It's not that we're going to produce everything right within our town borders, right? We see a large contribution from grid solar and then grid offshore, typically offshore wind, right? So in the end, we've reduced all of these non-renewable sources. We have a much lower energy load, and it's going to be all renewable, a contribution of local and regional sources.
So is hydroelectric so inconsequential for our region that we don't consider it?
That's a good question. We've kind of neglected that. And in Connecticut, there is some hydro. I think it was at 12 megawatts we have in Connecticut.
Basically, all in New England, it's only about 2 or 3%, so it is pretty much.
And there's potential, I think, for additional. Well, I'm telling Canton this, for additional hydroelectric on existing dams, right? We're probably not going to build any new dams, but as you know, it takes a while, right?
Yeah, we know.
This is you, Bernie, right?
Yeah. So we'll come back to the question about heat pump cost, but this is a 100,000 foot look at how much it would cost to make this transition. And there's some assumptions here. So put on your seatbelts. We know from the initial base benchmarking analysis how much energy Canton is using. It's a simple exercise. If you look over on the left to see how much it costs. So we're using, and these are out of date, I think. I don't know what our, but say electricity, 18 cents a kilowatt hour. Natural gas is $1.09 per 100 cubic feet. Oil, I think this number is lower now, $2.80.
Electric higher.
Say again.
The electric's a lot higher, though.
The electric is higher. And they move around season to season, so that's, you know, it is kind of what it is. But the 280 for would be for other heat like diesel, propane, and for gasoline. So using those numbers, and you can fiddle around with them and update them if you like. But this yields $31 million that we talked about before, and we say okay. Right now, at this moment, Canton is consuming 349 gigawatt hours per year. We have tried to convince you that adoption of efficiency and electrification is going to reduce that number substantially down to 139. So how big a solar array would we need to produce that 139? we need a 98 megawatt array. Let's just pretend we could. This is a mental exercise, just like Mark was saying. Pretend that we could plunk that down somewhere at $2.50 a watt. That array would cost $246 million. That's a lot of money. But it's going to be spread over 20 years in some sort of, just like a mortgage. Think of it like a mortgage. Likewise, you have 10,000 vehicles in Canton, 1,600 of them commercial, 8,600 of them residential. Again, we make up a number. What's the cost of switching? So we say $2,500 for to take your Sentra and make it be a Chevy Bolt, to take your garbage trucks and your school buses and so forth, switch them over. We're saying $25,000 per vehicle. Let me just say, right now, especially on the commercial side, that differential is greater. But as battery costs come down substantially, I think the $25,000 is going to be a decent number. So, say the cost, the investment to switch your vehicles over is call it $61 million. You've got 4,100 homes, residences, and 310 commercial buildings. And we have a cost to electrify that building. That cost represents the cost of the heat pump, and I think it's got a cost of building shell upgrade, whether it be insulation and air sealing built in, so that's 116. It's going to cost some money for the grid. So very long story told very quickly, total conversion cost is about $450 million. But we're going to spread that over 20 years. So when you spread it over 20 years, it's $1,407 for every resident in Canton. And for every employee, about $2,000. If you compare that down in the very bottom box to what we're now spending, it actually would cost less.
Yeah. So, Bernie, before you go on, are there any towns in the state that have converted or attempted to convert even partially to electric buses?
Yeah, that transition is beginning. I think Middletown has one on order. I think Fairfield, Mark might know more about this than I do. I think Fairfield is working on getting some. I think Bridgeport has purchased some electric, not school buses, but commuter buses. And right would now, that, go ahead, Mark. This is more your field.
Before you go on, would that $25,000 figure for buses, would that be the same number for school buses?
The figure right now, for school buses is much higher, right? But this $25,000 is sort of spread out over 20 years, right? So this transition is happening. There's very few of these right now. The Volkswagen settlement fund, where they got caught cheating on diesels, and there's money going to the states. Deep is issuing the third round of dishing that money out, and I believe there's a focus on electric vehicles. The first two rounds, there was only one electric school bus, but I think we can anticipate more in the third round. And eventually, probably with some federal subsidies, and we start to get these Bluebird and Thomas to start to build them right out of the factory over a 20-year period. At some point, we'll actually achieve cost parity. I think on the private passenger vehicles, we're actually only a few years away from an electric vehicle looking at a lifetime cost being actually equal.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I just to emphasize that last point, the lifetime cost. So when you have an electric vehicle, you don't have tune-ups, you don't have oil changes. you don't really replace your brakes hardly ever because you barely use them. You use the regenerative braking. And so the operating cost of these vehicles is a lot less. The, right now, the upfront cost is more. That's all the batteries. The battery costs are coming down year on year quite substantially.
And, you know, this whole economic analysis here, which has got lots of assumptions, doesn't reflect at all some of the health benefits of this transition or other sort of externalities that we're paying for right now.
But,
you know, another headwind here is battery life, battery storage life, and what do you do with the batteries when they're done, right? The recyclability of batteries, all that.
So Mark has a Tesla, and I bought a, and you guys can make fun of me when I say this, and I have a Chevrolet Bolt, B-O-L-T, which I love. But I before I bought it, I asked the question that you just asked, and they will recycle those batteries. And they'll recycle them in two stages. First, when they take it out of the car, so after, let's say, after 10 years, it still has a lot of utility in it. So it could stack up and be one of those storage devices on a microgrid, for example. And then they're going to take it apart even further, maybe because they're good people, but more likely because there's good stuff in there that they want to recycle. So the lithium and the cobalt, they want to get that stuff out and they want to keep it flowing. So I think you are going to see these things be recycled in a good way.
Have you heard anything about solar panel life expectancy after they're done? What are they going to do with the solar panels?
Yep. So right, I think your question is very timely. Maybe the first generation solar panels will. I reckon there's solar panels that are up in space that have been operating since the 1960s. So they kind of have a really long life unless they get hit by something. But in terms of a useful life, it might be 25 years, 30 years, something like that. And as they start taking them down, there's a lot of them. In Europe, they have you know, what they call lust to dust or cradle to grave, however you want to phrase it, requirements. So if you build a solar panel, you have to pay to take it apart. The technology certainly exists. I can find a website of somebody here in the States that does the recycling of them, and they, same deal. They want to get the aluminum out. They want to get some of the rare earth out, and then responsibly sort of crush the other stuff up. So the takeaway from that slide is we can invest in this with. If you think of our $31 million as an investment that we're it's an expense now that we can replace with an investment that's less than the expense. How are we going?
Yeah, I have another question sent to me. This is about heat pumps. You mentioned two towns are working on driving up the use of them. What have been the challenges those towns have faced?
We have just started with. Actually, Pace is it on here, Mark? I think engaging. Yeah. So number five on this chart. Get started. Pace is starting what we call a Heat Smart campaign. It's a town-based campaign modeled on the program that you know as Solarize. It's sort of the same basic community organization. It's just like the challenges that you faced with solar, say, 6 or 7 years ago. People say, okay, it's expensive, so we have some incentives. People will say, I don't know how this works, so we find some solar ambassadors to say, oh, I have a heat pump, or I have a solar panel, and this is how they work. Also, this is how they don't work for the lady that used to live in Alabama. We don't want to oversell these things. We want to sort of properly sell these things. We would look to find the value proposition. We see that your house needs to be air sealed. You'll use just less energy, period. Or you don't have air conditioning. Well, if you have a heat pump, you'll have air conditioning. So that we try to find the value proposition that makes sense for each individual person. Challenges, the cost, and I think Connecticut does have the highest cost per kilowatt hour of any state, the U.S., continental anyway. One paradox, one reason that rate is so high, and when you go home, look at your electric bill and look at your use charge versus your transmission and distribution charge. What you're going to see, if your bill is like mine, is that the transmission and distribution charge is becoming bigger every year. One reason that that is the case is that we are using less power year on year. So they have to spread the cost of the wires and poles over less kilowatt hours. Paradoxically, as we electrify and people use more juice, they'll be able to charge less for distribution and transmission. So that's it.
Bernie, they don't need to go home. They are home.
I know, it's funny.
Good point, Mark.
The other part of that question was to identify the towns that were working on this heat pump concept.
Sure. Yeah, so the program that's active right now is in Brantford. And if you look up Heat Smart Brantford, and we are just in the talking stages with Middletown.
I'm sorry, the second one, Will?
Middletown.
Middletown?
They haven't launched yet.
And they'll probably launch round two of Heat Smart in 2021. So other towns can then jump on.
Yeah, I mean, as you guys operate as a task force, we'll send out a request for a proposal and ask if Canton would be interested. It's a good program. Canton would be a good town. It's good to start on a small town. We better to start on a small town than New Haven or Hartford. Just to call your attention very quickly to the PACE 100%. Project. We have a guidebook online, which we really would love people to come and use. Certainly, it's aimed specifically at people like you. Organize your team. You've already kind of done that. Do the baseline energy analysis. We've talked through that at a million miles an hour. Work on an energy plan. Once you've got your baseline energy analysis, draft up an energy plan. And then start engaging the community, and then get started. And so there's a lot more information on the PACE website. That little graphic in the lower right is clickable and will take you to all sorts of information. It's tempting in this day and age to say we can't do anything. We're like the gang that can't shoot straight or can't shoot right. And it seems like these days we don't invest in infrastructure, we don't seem to do anything. And it's easy to forget what a powerful people we are. And Mark and I both love this example of the Erie Canal. And just let your mind think about this. It was proposed in 1808, it was finished 17 years later. It's 363 miles long, 40 feet wide, 4 feet deep. They didn't know how to make the cement. They had to invent the right kind of cement. They dug it all by hand. There's a story, it may or may not be true, that they had a lot of people from Europe. The way they motivated the workers to dig was every 10 miles there was a keg of whiskey there to get them going. And just like today, there's a lot of dissension between the federal government and local governments. It wasn't at all supported by the president, who at that time was James Madison. It was essentially a New York proposition. So think about that. If these guys can dig a ditch by hand, 363 miles long, build a bunch of locks and dams and invent stuff. And by the way, I don't know how many folks you have on your commission, but there's four leaders of this project, two lawyers, a math teacher, and an engineer. That was your project team, and they did this. So I think if they did that, we could do this. That's as close to inspiration as you're going to get out of an old actuary. Mark, is this one you?
Well, I think this is the end. I mean, you've got this in your handouts. One thing I would do is just maybe take a minute and look at the PACE website. Bernie said we have some resources. PACE really, our sole mission, as I said at the beginning, is helping towns, so that as you start to, if you want to do this type of energy analysis, we can help do it. If you want to start to do campaigns for efficiency or solar, and you've already done solar, but if you go to our website and go to this 100% CT, you'll see this image. And basically each of these boxes, if you click on it, it'll send you to a bunch of resources. And I'll just point out one, because I know many towns have taken a lot of time and spent a lot of effort to draft an energy plan. And if you click here on just energy plan box, you'll get to a page that gives you a little bit of background, some tips, checklist, and then a bunch of resources. And one of the things on here you'll find is an energy plan template. And I think we've got 3 or 4 towns now that have taken this template and have sort of made it their own. They sort of owned it. And I know Simsbury, we struggled for a very long time to get an energy plan done. And I think this template has helped some towns do it fairly quickly, including Brantford, who, Bernie has mentioned, they've done a really nice job. You look on their Clean Energy Task Force website, and they've done that. So there's just a ton of resources here that, again, if you want information on heat pumps, information on energy efficiency or community choice aggregation or electric vehicles, how to make your town ready for electric vehicles, we put as much as we can here. So that's a resource that we hope. And I guess maybe one last thing, and this is still in the beta version, but that is, in addition to giving towns just a bunch of resources, we're working on an action plan that is kind of like a sustainable Connecticut, that it's got a bunch of steps that you can take. So it's not just this bulletin board of a bunch of resources, but it's kind of a roadmap. So it's steps you can actually take. And we're working on fleshing this out so that we'll have a point value for each one, so you can kind of score yourself. But if you're a task force is looking for steps to take, maybe this will be a helpful resource. We're going to roll this out soon. It's not actually gone live yet.
I like your light bulb swap. I saw that one. That was good. Is Simsbury doing that?
The light bulb swap. We did a while ago. Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah,
West Harvard's done that a lot, right?
Yep. We spent our Bright Idea grants on that.
Are there any other questions from the committee?
No, I'd just like to compliment you guys. This was really, really a great effort. Thanks for doing this. I have a long history with Lou and Judy Friedman there, and it's really great to see that you guys have carried on the banner here after their passing, and it seems that PACE is doing better than ever. I was one of the solar tours my house years ago, and our firm was firm of the year by PACE about 10 years ago. So great organization, and great to see what you guys are doing. You know, we feel we've done a lot here over the last 10 years with our committee. We've put solar on all our schools now. We've done 2 rounds of Solarize. We've got the hydro project off the ground, and we've been struggling a little bit with how to go the next step, and we face the headwinds of finances in this town. Is that we're a pretty frugal town, and getting the town to invest anything is tough. But all of the solar on the schools is done with a performance contract. Didn't cost us a dime, and we got much cheaper electricity out of it. Same way with the hydro, under separate, outside of this committee, we just replaced all the windows in the high school, and that's done a good job of reducing energy. So we've done a lot, but I think what you've shown is a lot of stuff that we can continue to do, and I think that a lot of these things I think could be done through some sort of a performance contract, but we wouldn't really be looking to the town to pay, because I've gone before the Board of Finance several times now, and it's never, never, never. But similarly, we did get them, you know, we did leverage a lot of funding for a townwide energy conservation project that we're nearing completion on now for all of our town buildings. I think there's more that could be done, but we've, you know, we've gone a long way there. So I think really what I would love to see going forward are, you know, for example, all the PV canopies at the high school and potentially at the shops and stuff. You know, we're not going to be able to pay for that, but if we could find a way to leverage that you know, just make it attractive or at the minimum cost neutral, I think those kind of things could go ahead, you know, and the idea of heat pumps like a solarized kind of thing. I'm actually looking at my house now. Are some great opportunities. So I just compliment you. It's a great effort. Opened our eyes to some stuff that we, you know, we're really struggling. Where do we go next? And I personally would love to see us continue to work with you and you know, make some of this stuff happen.
So. Dave, one point. Everybody's struggling, and we work with the CT Energy Network, which I think it was founded by Clean Water Action. So we. And the value of that is that there's a whole bunch of us now. And so to the extent that Canton makes a breakout, disrupt their approach, and Brantford's doing something, we can learn from each other. So I think we can get this fibrous network of motivated people at the local level and work together and leverage each other. It's a good way to go.
Yeah, and as you say, I know when we go before our Board of Selectmen in Simsbury, we typically, the first slide sort of is a history of things we've done, and every single one of them to save the town money, either didn't cost any money, we got, you know, had a power purchase agreement or a performance contract of some kind. So fortunately, a lot of the numbers are starting to, these projects are becoming easier to do economically. But and you probably availed yourself of, are you in Sustainable Connecticut?
I don't know.
if you're registered for the Sustainable CT program, then there are matching grants available for a lot of these type of projects. You have to crowdfund, and then you can put some money from the task force in. And the Heat Smart program, if our funding continues, it provides a grant to each town, to, you know, for marketing and things.
Great.
Yeah, the patron is called Patronicity. It's in our backyard is the name of the crowdsourcing platform, and they'll match dollar for dollar up to $25,000. So it's a lot of work because that means people like us have to kick in, you know, money to get it matched. But I think, you know, if you think about motivating a parent teacher association or a group of people like yourself or the Nature Conservancy, it's great. If you get a dollar, you have $2.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to mention, Sustainable CT is, sometimes think of them as our big brother or big sister. They have all sorts of projects, and we try to fit ourselves into things that make sense from their perspective.
Just for the record, we are not in Sustainable Connecticut. That phone number at the start of the meeting that was not identified, Glenn, for your records, Guy West has been on the call the whole time.
Okay.
And he just sent me the message that we are not in it. He's had some problems with unmuting his phone.
Yeah, Dawn is also on. I just got an email from her. And so she has been on also, having the same problem.
Okay, but yeah. Guy's been here since the start of the meeting.
Good.
For the record.
Well, that CT Energy Network that I talked about, that was, Guy is connected with Clean Water Action, so that's their organization. So he knows very well what that is all about.
Does Simsbury have a sustainability director?
We do not. It's all volunteer. We basically work with we have a sustainable Simsbury team, but we do not have an energy. I know West Harbor's got an energy manager. But we don't have any. We work very closely with the Director of Public Works.
When you go before the town for monies, how resistant, or let me ask it in positive, how supportive is the town projects that you come before them with?
we haven't had to go before the town to ask for money much. I think the biggest exception I can think of was buying the streetlights from Eversource and then relamping them. But yeah, the economics were a slam dunk on that one.
Yeah.
Bernie, you may have more experience with going and asking. You know, most of what we've done has been these power purchase agreements, no money down, building solar, and we've actually brought grants, these Bright Ideas grants, and money from Energize CT.
Our experience, like Dave said, we've got solar, I think, on, we have 16 schools. I think we're up to 12, but it's all PPAs, and so it's not any capital outlay.
Have you done PPAs for canopies yet? And that's, you know, kind of our, we just did all of our schools, and we did it as a PPA, and we've worked with Ross Solar, now Con Ed, in doing that. And we actually went out for an RFP, but we ended up with 5.5 cents kilowatt hour, power price for generation off them. And it was fantastic. You know, it was really a win-win. But, of course, it's cheaper to do it on the roof than it is to do it as a canopy. Have you seen PPAs for canopies be cost-effective in this area?
Fairfield, the town of Fairfield, their sustainability team has been successful in doing some solar carports at the school using PPAs. Hmm. And we can put you in touch with them. We're actually, as I mentioned, we're doing a lot of work on solar canopies right now. So we've been in conversation with a couple of installers. And the economics can be challenging. As you said, it is more expensive. You got to build a structure. But Fairfield has done it. So I think if the conditions are right, it's doable if it's a good location. So I would definitely, you know, we intend to explore that in more detail, flesh out the economics. So maybe next time we talk, we'll have some more information.
Hmm. One kind of comment is, one reason the economics are challenging, obviously it's an highly engineered structure with a lot of steel, and you gotta have it, deep foundations, etc. But there's a lot of soft costs. If we sat down and said, okay, we're gonna put, like Mark knows how many parking lots there are in Simsbury. He's done his own town. And if we said to somebody, we're gonna cover, you know, 20 of them with canopies, a lot of the soft costs are going to go away. That solar company that is going to know that they have 4 years of work, and they're going to buy in bulk, and they're going to have their workforce lined up, as opposed to how we operate on all these projects now, which is you have to go. It's like we're like hunter gatherers. We have to go out, find the wildebeest, catch the wildebeest, bring it back to the cave, cook it up. If we just started farming the wildebeests. And I think that's one of the motivations behind the 100% CT project is we're going bean by bean, and we really ought to go, you know, town by town, ought to be at a higher scale. So some of the soft costs would go away. But that's a pie in the sky.
Well, thank you very much for having us. It's been really a pleasure. It's been a great discussion.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
You've also given us maybe a path that we can pursue, or maybe three paths. I'm not certain at this point. But it's been very illuminating. So thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you.
We certainly appreciate the time. What level of ongoing support? I mean, you know, you guys were very very enlightening here. We'd love to have you come to every meeting, you know, but you probably got a lot of towns that would like that. You know, is it something that, you know, maybe, I don't know, quarterly you might want to attend one of our meetings and we work with you on something like that? I mean, is that a reasonable request?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I'd recommend is this Connecticut Energy Network. You know, it's this group of people like yourselves. We get together. We've had 5 meetings this year. They're of course all on Zoom right now, but the PACE website has all of the at least for the past year, there are all the presentations are up there. So this guy from Fairfield, who's done all this, Scott Thompson, as they've been successful in getting solar on carports at the school, and his presentation is up on that site, and just listening to them, I can. I'll put the link in the. I didn't see a chat. Is there a chat? I'll send Glenn the link to that presentation. That one alone is the type of stuff that this Connecticut Energy Network is just really valuable for, because you see people are doing these things. But yeah, we'd be happy to stay in touch, come back to some meetings. This action list, this action plan that we're promoting and this they were developing, and this idea, we're actually taking some individual towns and trying to estimate the total potential for solar on carports. We'd love to, if you guys want to work with us, you know, Canton could be one of the pilots for that. So yeah, I'd love to stay in touch.
Sounds good.
Okay, well, you guys get to enjoy your evening. We have a bit more to do.
You got other items on your agenda. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you, Bernie.
Bye. Bye-bye.
All right, so looks like we're at number 5. Energy efficiency upgrades. Glenn, that must be you.
Yep, and I have some good news and not great news, but I'll give you the good news first. The good news first is that boiler installs are done, functioning properly. A little bit of a hiccup at Town Hall last week where Mr. Skinner's office was 81 degrees and I think the assessor's office was down in the 40s. But that was a control problem that was resolved within 24 hours. So
not a hot air problem.
I'm not even going to touch that one. So it really has been going pretty well at Town Hall. So they are done. And, of course, all the lighting is also done at Town Hall. I did a walkthrough with Will Giblin from PTE and confirmed all the lighting work. It's all gone well there. The not-so-great news is at the high school. And because of COVID-19 protocols, it's very difficult to schedule work during school hours. They've kind of been restricted to after school and as long as the custodial staff is in the building. They have had a few days. There's been some days where students and staff have not been in the building, usually on Wednesdays. But that's not the case now. Now school is 100% full time. So they are really restricted in their hours, which could push the project out to the very last minute. This morning we had a thread where all the stakeholders, including the principal, talked about possibly getting custodial staff to work a little bit later so the contractors could put in a full 8-hour day. It looks like that's going to be possible. So going forward, I think we're going to be in much better shape as far as scheduling goes. As far as the installations go, the boilers there are also fully installed, fully operational. Lighting is taking a long time because it's classroom to classroom to classroom. On the other hand, parking lot lighting is finished and looks great. We had a town meeting a couple weeks ago for our local bridges and the parking lot looked great. So, you know, it's not the end of the world, but it's taking a little longer than what we had hoped for. But it should be resolved going forward and who knows what's going to happen. If schools wind up shutting down, then, you know, the guys can all be in there from 7 till 7 if they want, you know, so they can really speed
when you
it
say
up.
To the last minute, I mean, I'm frankly, you know, frustrating. It takes a little longer, but it's certainly understandable under the circumstance here. But is when you say to the last minute, does it jeopardize funding or anything like that if we don't get it done by a certain date?
Well, there are no extensions granted. There's no grantable extension. I don't know how strict they're going to be. Will Giblin and Dave Carpenter, you know, they kind of make it sound like it's going to be really hard to get it done on time if we don't go to an accelerated schedule. So they haven't, but no, Dave, they have not specifically said that there's going to be any kind of penalty. But I fear that there might be. It's not something that I want to take a chance with. So that's why we put our heads together to try to, you know, amend the schedule and make it a faster track, at least as fast as possible with all the protocols that are in place.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Hydro project.
The hydro project is pretty interesting. What's going on? So, kind of the big thing is that they want to be operational by the end of the calendar year, which is a big maybe. Wow.
I went by the other day. It looks like a big maybe. I mean,
it's a big maybe.
They're working down there, but man, it looks like they got a long way to go.
They do, yeah. So a couple things that they still need to do. They need to finish the fish ladder, which is a large task. There are gates. Apparently, there's four bay gates at the Axe Factory, which I'm not 100% sure what they're for. I think maybe a flow restriction or a control of flow that have to be repaired. And in order for those to be repaired, because they fall under the ownership of the owners of the Axe Factory, the hydro people have to get them to agree to allow them to basically drain the area of the forebay so they can get in there and repair the gates, which is ongoing. I guess they're in talks about getting that done. So that's what they're hoping for, though. If both of those things can get done by the end of the year, they should be ready to go. It's a big task. And that's about it on hydro.
Any other questions on the hydro? So do they employ more than two people at a time?
It's a skeleton crew. I don't understand why it's such a small group. I think probably, the engineers probably outnumber the workers. I've seen that. Yeah, I've noticed that.
Yep.
All right. I know you all read the minutes from the last meeting of October 20th, but in case you didn't, they start on page 41 of the handout. I will give you a few moments to refresh your memory on this.
I've got them up on the screen for you if that helps.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Can you scroll?
If you just want to tell me where to go with them, I can go. I can go anywhere you want with them.
A page, next page, or?
Keep going. Is there like a specific section that you want?
No, I'm just reading scanning.
Yeah.
Rereading, Candace, of course.
Reread, yeah. Okay.
And there's your 7:15 start times for 2021.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Now that we have refreshed our memories, I'll entertain a motion. Why, thank you, Dan.
So, I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
And seconded by?
I can't second because you're missing my name from being present.
So, that's
right. We need
right.
to amend. Second.
I need a second.
I'll second.
Thank you, Mark. Any discussion on the motion?
No.
Oh, where's that thing, Candace? Yeah. We can vote on the...
Yeah, you can vote. You have to click on the people icon.
Yeah, I don't see it.
And then you can raise your hand. See, I'm raising my hand.
Yeah, I don't see the people icon.
I don't either.
But take your mouse and go towards the bottom of your screen, and then it pops up.
Participants.
Participants.
Oh, participants?
Yeah. Click on that, and then you can raise your hand.
Look at the very bottom.
Yeah, I can't. I don't get this.
I got it.
Now I see it. Okay.
Right there.
All right.
Got my thumb
hey,
up.
What about you?
I put my thumb up. I couldn't get a hand to raise it.
Okay, the motion is passed. we're done with that part. Let's go to my report. There is none. Staff report.
Okay, so this is the energy usage that you've been asking me for since the Stone Age. I had a chat with Bobby Martin, our public works director, about how George Wallace used to handle this, and I did locate, I mean, in the hundreds and hundreds of files that George left for me to go through, I was only able to find a single document that actually touched upon this, and it was an Excel spreadsheet that, and I don't know if any of you have ever seen this, it's pages long, and it has kilowatt hours and stuff like that on it. But it was very unclear as to where, for example, the energy usage for any given town, building, or facility, and how that matched up with the type, you know, whether it was oil or gas. Or so I actually sent it over to Mark Scully to get his take on it, and he wrote back and said it's basically useless, but because you kind of need the Rosetta Stone, right, to figure out what George was thinking. I'm sorry about that. I've run into a lot of this, but I guess...
Glenn, when we did the project at the police station, he gave those to us monthly.
Yeah.
Broken Excel spreadsheets, broken down by the different categories.
Oh, my goodness, really?
And he did it, I think... from the beginning of the project, from the time the project was completed, I think he updated those spreadsheets almost a full year.
Yeah, pretty much did it. Yeah. I never saw the original files, but he would give us a comparative energy use from
before
and after the.
There's a lot of information somewhere.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. I really don't, because. It's literally hundreds and hundreds of different files on different subjects. Most of them are categorized by date and not by subject. I know Heather's been going through them as much as she can. I've been trying to, you know, figure out what's what and properly put it in different files. I guess what I really, and what Bobby thought I should ask of you folks is, maybe you could give me some guidance on what kind of a format you'd like me to use, and all the information that I'm assuming you want energy at each town facility, broken down by whatever the type of fuel, let's say, is being used, whether it's oil heat or gas heat, or and then of course what all you know the kilowatts are and all that. I'm assuming that you want to know over a year, over a 1 year period, maybe, like if we could go back 1 year up to the current month, and you know, and I could probably work up something like that for you.
We were trying to assess the impact of the projects that we had on the town.
The solar projects?
Conservation too.
You know, the solar is pretty predictable. I'm sure they have that output metered, so we can see you know, how much that's producing, and you know, it is pretty predictable in terms of have a little variation in cloud cover solar, but year to year it's pretty pretty predictable. Energy conservation is a lot tougher because it has to do with weather effects, and it also has to do with building usage, and particularly in all this COVID thing, building usage is going to be a wild card. But in my mind, really, all we want to know is, you know, month to month, you know, take the high school, for example, how much gas and how much electricity were we using in all the months prior to the, a year prior to the retrofit, and then start comparing month by month the year after. Now, if you have a warm winter, you know, you're going to use less heat, but that can be levelized looking at degree days and stuff, you know. So, just start with, you know, before and after, month to month for each building. And that's pretty much what George did, you know.
Okay.
we have before that. I mean, we can just go back to the meeting minutes because he used to attach that to the meeting minutes.
Okay, so, all right.
The other thing is, someone should be able to call George and say, "Where's that file?" You know.
Yeah, and I did, you know. and he sent me the file, and that's what came up. So.
Okay.
There's probably more than just that, but that's the one that he sent me.
Yeah.
So when you say
he didn't really do calculations, right? He was just literally taking the energy bills that we were paying every month, right?
Yeah.
And
he did calculations.
He did
calculations.
Yes, he showed in terms of real number and percentages the reduction.
Yeah.
The reduction of use,
right. Okay. Yeah.
But it was fuel use or energy use in whatever form before and after. But then he compared it to a one of the non-modified buildings to see how they performed before and after to account for the impacts of weather, you know. And that wasn't perfect, you know, way to do it, but it was a way to, you know.
So how far back should I go? When? So you talked about a retrofit, Dave, at the high school.
Well, the high school retrofit is, you know, when it's completed, which hopefully will be in a couple months, right?
Less hopefully,
If we took, you know, a year before that, you know, it was probably getting semi retrofitted along the way over the last few months when they were working on it. But if you took, you know, the year starting before they began the retrofit and compared it to a year after the retrofit was complete, you know, that's a good starting point. But the only difference then being utilization and weather effects, you know.
Okay.
Glenn, because I think I'm the only person. Oh, Mark is also. I'm retired. I could drop by with my book to show you what he gave us.
Okay.
Because I see those. And if you could find those, I mean, I hate the thought that you'd reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, well, I'll look. What I didn't think of looking at is basically the, monthly packet where he probably included it. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'll do tomorrow. That's the first place I'm going to look tomorrow morning.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Good.
Yeah, but Bob, I would certainly be thrilled if you want to stop by and, you know, once I find something or if you have something that you want to bring to me, you know, I'm there. So just give me a call.
You find it's hard to believe. I don't hear that very often.
Well, okay. You know, I mean, if there's anything that you guys, you know, that you can do to help me help you, that's kind of where I'm coming from. So.
Any other questions of Glenn? That's part of the meeting. I'll call for adjournment.
Right.
Motion by Mark. Thank you. And seconded by Kim. Do we get to raise our hands again? Let's do it electronically. This is so much fun.
I know. I can do it.
I'll put my thumb up again. Oops.
All right. So there's no... opposition to it. We are adjourned. Thanks, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
very interesting. Thank
good
you.
Yep.
Have a good night.
Thanks,
Same to you. Same to you all.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.